I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host, and with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
2017 is in full swing now, and you know what that means? New movies for us to enjoy. If you listened to our previous episode, where we reviewed our favorite films of 2016, you know that we three found 2016 to be a bit lacking when it comes to cinema. Sure, there were great movies, but the majority of films seemed lackluster when we looked back upon them at year-end. But enough looking backward, it's time to look forward at all the films we're going to see this year. It's like looking out across a field of freshly fallen snow. It's a clean slate. Everything is new and full of potential. On this episode, we're going to be listing our top three most anticipated movies of 2017, and let me tell you, I have a good feeling about this year in cinema. So join us, won't you, as we look forward at 2017, right after this. The Back Row is dedicated to delivering free entertainment to everyone in the forms of media culture blogging, movie reviews, short films, podcasts, and more. That's awesome, I hear you say, and you're right. It is pretty awesome, so why don't you help us out by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes and leaving a review? Just search the iTunes store for Shouts from the Back Row to subscribe to our feed. And if you're feeling generous, visit the-back-row.com and click the donate button to send us a few bucks. Your support means the world to us. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, just about everything else we've been doing. So, Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, this week I finally got around to seeing La La Land, which I know you guys talked about in the previous episode, and I'd say I'm pretty much in the middle with it. I wasn't too wild about it, but then I'm not really a big musicals fan to begin with. Like, I was never too fond of the old-style Hollywood musicals from, like, yesteryear, so I don't really have a lot of nostalgia for it. Overall, I thought the opening scene was terrific. I thought it was definitely the highlight of the movie, the big spontaneous song and dance number on the crowded freeway. And I thought the conclusion was really strong as well. It kind of went against what you would expect and was pretty cleverly done. So I'd say it was pretty much a strong opening and a strong ending, but it kind of dragged for me in between. I thought it had some pretty decent numbers in it and stuff, but I have with a lot of musicals is that they usually are attached to like a story. Like, I didn't really get too invested in these characters too much and their love story. I thought they were likable enough, but I just found that it just started to drag after a while. I remember, I know J.K. Simmons has kind of like a one-scene cameo in it, and when he disappeared, I was just kind of hoping for him to keep popping up and start yelling at people again like he did in Whiplash, but no such luck. So it kind of became... But it was an enjoyable enough time. It lives up to the hype. I agree with your analogy when you were talking about The Artist last week, that The Artist, like, a lot of people liked it because they felt really nostalgic about how well it recreated, like, silent films. But here we are, like, 6 years later, and nobody really remembers it. Like, it kind of faded from view. And I kind of feel that's going to be the same thing here, where people enjoy it at the time, but it's not going to be, like, a long-lasting classic or anything like that. Happens. I'm sure it's going to get a lot of recognition at Oscar time, but I don't think I would place it as near my favorite movie.
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate my thoughts, I enjoyed it well enough, but as you said, Robin, I don't think it's going to have much staying power after Oscar season. And ultimately, the problem with films like La La Land and The Artist is they can only be as good as the movies they're imitating. And if you're trying to imitate a movie style, well, then you might as well, like, you, the viewer, might as well just go and watch one of those movies. You know, I'm a lot more likely to go and watch, say, Singing in the Rain than I am to rewatch La La Land. So it is a charming movie, but I don't feel like it will have longevity. I don't think we're going to be talking about it, you know, 5 years from now. I until you mentioned it, Robin, I didn't even realize it's been 6 years since The Artist won an Oscar. That's how little I think about that movie. But TK, I know you really enjoyed La La Land. Would you care to reiterate what you think?
I just thought it was a solidly well-put musical, and unlike you, Robin, I love musicals and love the old-school musicals, so this, like, a whole bunch of nostalgic notes for me as well. I just thought the story was really well done, and I liked Gosling and Stone as the leads. I thought they had some really good chemistry, and I actually like, there's a few sequences in the middle of the film I actually really enjoy, particularly the dinner scene. I got a big kick out of it. I thought that was really well done, but I do agree with you. The opener and closers were really strong, and them going against type, I think, is a really big strong point for the film. But I love the soundtrack to this too, like, just love it. And that always helps.
Apparently that trick where you put your key fob under your chin and use your head as an antenna, apparently that actually does work and doesn't give you cancer. So if nothing else, hot tip from La La Land, you can use your head like an antenna to find your car.
Oh, good to know. All right. Actually, I remember you telling me last week that how Caitlin absolutely hated the film. Could you reiterate the reasons why? I'm curious now that I've seen it.
So she came out of it, and she was just, like, seething mad. And I was surprised because, like, if she doesn't like a film, usually she'll just be like, ah, that was crap, and, you know, just never really talk about it again. It takes a lot to actually get her riled up. And from what I could tell, because it took me a while to actually, like, zero in on why she felt that way. She was just so, like, enraged with it. But from what I can tell from our conversation, and she agreed with this assessment, she started debating as to whether it counted as a musical at all, because there weren't really songs. Like, there were a couple of songs, but there weren't enough songs to really call it a musical. And if you've studied musicals, like I studied musicals when I was in film school, you know, the typical musical structure has, like, a song at the beginning that is reprised at the end. The two lovers often have a song that they sing to each other again and again throughout the film. La La Land is not that type of musical. It's much more in the style of something like a Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers musical, where the numbers are less about songs and more about just, like, cutting a rug and, you know, high energy and that great camera work that you guys mentioned as well, especially in the opening and closing numbers. So, first off, Caitlin did not like La La Land because she just didn't like the type of musical that it was. She wanted it to, she was expecting a different type of musical out of it. Second is, she did not think that Gosling and Stone were talented enough to carry the movie, especially Ryan Gosling. She thought his singing was just not good. And, I mean, you can have your taste. Fair point, I guess. He's obviously not a professional singer. And on top of that, I think she just didn't like how it would go along and she'd start getting invested and then it would be interrupted with what she considered to be a mediocre dance number or a mediocre song. So it seemed like those were the things that bothered. Also, she generally just doesn't like Ryan Gosling. Like, she loved The Nice Guys, but as we all noted on our last episode when we were singing the praises of The Nice Guys, one of the most surprising things about it is neither Ryan Gosling nor Russell Crowe are actors that we particularly enjoy, but they were so good in that film that it really made it stand out. Well, Caitlin generally doesn't like Ryan Gosling, and so she did not like him there in La La Land.
Yeah, I can kind of see it. I thought Gosling was okay, but he didn't really overwhelm me with, like, his singing and dancer. Like, you'll never confuse him with, like, Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly. And it is true that, like, I was actually expecting more musical numbers as it goes along, that it was kind of sporadic. So it is almost like a love story that just happens to have musical numbers, like, strewn in every now and then rather than a full-fledged musical. So I can see where that complaint came from. But we'll have to see if this movie, like, captures all the awards, because I know I think it set a record for the most Golden Globes ever won by a film in 1 year. So we'll see if the Academy embraces this film.
It swept the Golden Globes. Like, it really took home a bunch of awards there. And since then, I've actually seen a lot of online backlash. It seems like the shine has faded a bit, and now people are saying, oh, it's not, it's good, but it's not that good. It's not, however, it's not a dozen Golden Globes good. But, something that I have thought of whenever I think of La La Land now and sort of try to examine it through a critical eye, if there's one thing that bothers me about the movie, and just to say it again, I thought this was a fine movie, so, take this as you will, but I think it's actually kind of hypocritical, because the movie keeps championing how great it is to be, to do your own thing, to do your own independent thing, and they keep talking about how Hollywood sucks, and it's all just recycled garbage, and selling out is terrible. But this is a movie that's getting all this critical acclaim. It stars two Hollywood stars. I'm sure. I am so sure it's going to win Best Picture. Isn't that just doing what it's trying to decry? Like, isn't it committing the very crime that it claims to be against? It's a little hypocritical, in my opinion. But still a fun time.
Yeah, quite an interesting catch-22 there, where you want to be as successful as possible, but you don't want to denounce the film's message. That's interesting.
Well, the whole thing about Gosling's character and his jazz club, right? He's so enamored with the old ways of things, and the new way sucks. And yet, here we are, right? And La La Land is the new thing.
Interesting. As far as what else I've been up to, I've actually got a new podcast to recommend called Suspect Convictions, which just started this early January and has already gone to the top of the iTunes charts. This is considered to be this year's new series that goes out and looks at a controversial conviction. It involves a case about a 9-year-old girl named Jennifer Lewis, who was not only raped back in 1999, but her body was set on fire with him. He had his conviction overturned twice. He was reconvicted at the second trial, and they're actually going to go into his third trial this spring. And that's kind of what's interesting about this one, is that unlike Serial, this one is actually, they are literally making it as they go along, because his trial is coming up in the spring. So this podcast will be the result of this trial. They've actually only released 5 episodes now for January, which kind of detail the backstory of the case, and they're going to release more of them gradually as the months go on, which go further into the problems with the case, and also will cover his motions and his preliminary hearings before they actually get to the trial. And it's interesting how listening to the first 5 episodes, they don't pull any punches. It's pretty fair and balanced. Like, this isn't a pro-innocent piece, because you realize that even though he may not have committed this particular crime, Stanley Liggins is still a pretty bad guy. He does have 1 child molestation charges, but he might not be guilty of this crime. But I think they're going to reveal their big stuff later on, because you find out that his convictions have been overturned on technicalities, but you're not finding out any evidence that points to his innocence just yet. But apparently you're going to find out that a lot of the evidence that was against him was fabricated, but they're kind of keeping that secret for now. So I'm really excited to see where this goes on. I've listened to 5 episodes in pretty much one night, and I have to wait a couple more weeks to hear the next ones, but really anxious to see it. And little teaser here, but there is soon going to be a tie-in between Suspect Convictions and The Trail Went Cold, which is going to be pretty exciting for us. So stay tuned. I'll talk more about that in the future.
I should really start listening to Suspect Convictions, especially now that there is going to be a Trail Went Cold connection.
Yes, definitely. So I have a feeling that you might, if you get into it, you might be hearing The Trail Went Cold mentioned in relation to it sometime soon. And I also want to mention that The Trail Went Cold also has a new episode out this week. This one is about the stabbing of a French citizen named Hugues de la Plaza in San Francisco, and it's quite an interesting case where he was found stabbed 3 times in his apartment and the knife was in the sink, and they actually tried to say he committed suicide by stabbing himself 3 times and then washing the knife before he died. It's probably the worst police investigation I've ever featured on one of my episodes, so be sure to check it out. We're only growing further in audience as we go further and further along, so I was excited about this week's episode. And, of course, per usual, you'll get another mini-sode next week. And that's about all I've been up to.
TK, what have you been up to?
So last week I talked about how I started to watch Louis C.K.'s show Horace and Pete, which I finished a couple of days ago. Now, I am going to not recommend this to you two guys because it's beautifully crafted. It's like I described it last week. It's like watching a 10-hour play that's really well put together, but it's really depressing, like really bad. It's about a family that has all these issues and hate each other, and it's just brutal to watch. But everything about it is fantastic. Like, it's shot really well. It's scripted. The script is amazing. And the acting is spot on. It's exactly what it needs to be. And I don't think I've seen a show this well put together in a while. So it's kind of nice that, despite the content, I think that in of itself is refreshing, but it's such a downer show. Holy jeez.
Now I want to jump in here and say, why do you think that I wouldn't like something that is depressing?
No, like, this is really depressing, Gil. Like,
Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, this is worse.
What? No.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Impossible.
No, it isn't. This is worse. I am not lying. this is probably the most, like Grave of the Fireflies, like Requiem for a Dream. This is the most depressing thing I think I've seen.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I watch a lot of depressing indie movies, and like, this is takes the cake entirely. Like, watch an episode, and if you want to continue with that downward spiral, like, please do, but at the same time, just please keep my heat is in the back of your head. I did warn you.
Your anti-recommendation has done the opposite, because now I'm really curious. I'm going like, it can't, how could it be more depressing than Requiem for a Dream or Grave of the Fireflies? Like, those are some of the most depressing movies ever made.
I just heard that and I was like, challenge accepted. You say more depressing than Requiem for a Dream. How is that even possible?
Oh, yeah.
It's on. It's on now.
It's real. Okay, well, you guys go ahead, and if you do watch it, let me know, and we'll discuss it further. But holy geez, rough. I also watched Bo Burnham's Make Happy comedy special a week or two ago and really enjoyed it. I was kind of lukewarm on him at first, but this special, I think, is really well put together. A lot of really good laughs, a lot of really good meta commentary, and I had a really good time watching it.
I also love it. I think it's actually all on YouTube. I know it's for sure on Netflix, and I think Bo Burnham is one of the most promising stand-up comics working today. He's just this young guy, but he's really hit upon this amazing style of stand-up comedy. It's like one part musical, and there's a lot of whimsy, but he also pulls the same trick as someone like George Carlin, where he talks about like language and social norms and, you know, why do we think about these things, or why doesn't anybody talk about these things that we all share? So I just really love his style of comedy, and Make Happy I found to be like almost transcendent as far as stand-up comedy specials go, because, you know, in one moment he will be talking very sincerely to the audience about how we all live in a world now where everybody is a performer. We all have cameras and we can all just create. They gave us the tools and now we can just go out there and make whatever we want, and it has never been easier. But if you can survive without needing an audience, then you should do that. And it's just like, that's an interesting message. And then the next sketch that he does might be about how he looked down at the urinal next to him and was jealous of how beautiful the man's penis was. And he does like a whole scene where he pretends the microphone is this guy's dick. So he really runs this gamut of like from literal toilet humor to just really philosophical and interesting, thoughtful humor. And I think it's fascinating. I think it's really great.
Yeah. His ending performance is my favorite bit of the show. I was really, really impressed with that. What else have I been doing? And the last thing I'll talk about is that today I watched Hunt for the Wilder People, which, Gil, you recommended a while ago. And it was a movie, I'm going to butcher his name. Someone help me out here. Waititi is the last name?
Taika Waititi.
Waititi. I enjoy his stuff. I think he's a very gifted writer and director. And this was a really... the way I described it, I wrote about it on Letterboxd. This film is full of tropes I've seen before, but did them in such a way that they didn't bother me at all. And the levity in the film, I think, made up for everything. The soundtrack is fantastic. And I like seeing Sam Neill, and grizzled Sam Neill is even better, I think. But it's just, it's kind of like this sweet connection story, just in a really oddly framed way. And it was, really good. I'd highly recommend it if you guys haven't seen it.
I really enjoyed it too. And just to jump on what you're saying, my review of the film is basically that it's a coming of age story that is evocative of coming of age movies from the 80s without being set in the 80s. Like, it feels like, you know, that type of kid lost in the wilderness coming of age story, like maybe Stand By Me or something along those lines from the 1980s. And the synthesizer soundtrack, which I love, evokes that atmosphere as well, but it's set in the present and it's modern. And I found that to be a really neat balancing act that it pulls off. And it's really clever and funny. And the main kid, Ricky, who plays Ricky Baker, I wish I knew his name offhand, but he's great. I really liked him.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun. He was really, really good.
What were you saying? You were messaging me as you were watching it and saying you had been to a bunch of those locations?
Yeah, it was really funny. There's this right at the beginning of the film, they're going over all these things that Ricky has done. They're talking about like spitting and setting things on fire and like spraying graffiti, and like they show these quick clips of like all these places around Auckland, New Zealand, where, and I'm like, I've been there. It was kind of funny. Just pointing out landmarks I've been to. It was cool. That's all I've been up to, gentlemen.
I haven't been up to a whole lot since our last episode, but I have been taking in some Netflix media. Netflix has a couple of new series out that I've been watching. And I'm going to start by talking about this series called The OA, which is a collaboration between writer-actress Britt Marling and writer-director Zal Batmanglia. I'm butchering his name. His first name's Zal. Anyway, this pair have collaborated on a number of movies up until this point, and I've seen two of them. I've seen Sound of My Voice, and I have seen The East is the other one of theirs that I've seen. And I quite liked Sound of My Voice. I thought The East was not especially good. And now they've made an 8-part Netflix series called The OA. And so let me just preface this review by saying sorry to my listeners, because I'm pretty sure, I believe that my sister listens to this podcast, and I think my friend Steve tunes in from time to time, and they both loved The OA. But guys, I'm really sorry. I've watched two episodes and I hate this show. I just hate it. It's, oh man. Like, okay, it's 8 episodes long and I kind of feel like I need to finish it. The show is definitely constructing a mystery, and they are doling out the information piece by piece in this very deliberate fashion. And I should say that, you know, around the midpoint of each of the two episodes that I've watched, and each episode is an hour long, right around the half hour mark, I start going like, okay, but where is this? Like, get on with it. And I start getting bored, and it just like draws the show's flaws into glaring relief, because I get kind of sick of it for a while. But each of these episodes that I've seen, it ends in a way that makes me go like, okay, but what happens next? Like, it has definitely piqued my curiosity. But boy, oh boy, there are just so many things that I have seen in other collaborations from Britt Marling and Zal Batmangli, or Batmangi. They really have like this checklist of tropes that they put into every single one of their properties. And it worked in Sound of My Voice, because that was like the first film from them, and it felt fresh and new. But the more of their stuff that I see, the more I realize, Like, they love complex iconography, like symbols. They really like weird symbols and decoding codes and ciphers. They really like very like spiritual sounding philosophy that doesn't actually have to do with like spirituality or religion. It's just, it's like faux new agey stuff. And kind of, and one of the things that really bugs me, especially about the OA, is that there's this sort of like anti-science rhetoric running through the whole thing. Britt Marling plays the main character, and she is constantly talking about how, no, the doctors are wrong, I shouldn't be taking my medication, don't listen to science, science is wrong, and it really pisses me off. You know, like, as I'm watching it, I'm going, this woman should be on medication. Like, she, oh my God. It's too much. It's too much. And it really drives me crazy. And, they also, for some reason, this writer, actor, director team, they also really love, like, weird, complex, secret handshakes. Like, specifically, like, weird, secret handshake motions. And in almost every movie. And they've always got some, like, underground organization or cult where it's like, okay, I need five people for very, you're each very important, you'll each serve a purpose in the end, and at first you won't believe me, but by the end of this you will believe me, and you just have to trust me. Like, what I just said applies to every single one of their collaborations. So, those things bug me. But here's the thing about the OA that really just tips it over the edge for me. It is so convoluted. So convoluted. So here, guys, I will demonstrate this, and I'll demonstrate this without even spoiling very much. I'm going to just describe the plot of the first episode. This is one episode, the first episode that I'm about to describe. So, a woman is spotted jumping off of the Brooklyn Bridge. She is discovered to be this person who went missing 7 years ago, and when she went missing, she was blind. But now that she is turned up again, she can see. She befriends a group of high school students, including a butch girl, a guy who is struggling because his mother's sick, and he's, like, this teenager's the only one supporting his family. The school bully, who is also dealing drugs and is being threatened with military school. Who's the fourth one? The fourth one is just, like, the bully's best friend, who's kind of like a nerdy outcast. And then also one of the high school teachers is, like, roped into this, and she tells them to meet her at an abandoned house at midnight, and when they meet her there, they're supposed to leave the doors to their houses open. This is really important for some reason. And they all get there, and she tells them a story about how when she was a child, she was the daughter of a Russian oligarch who was also a violin prodigy, and in an attack against her father by his enemies, her school bus is blown up and shot into a body of water, and her heart stops. And when her heart stops, she goes to, like, this new age, heaven-like place that I swear to God looks like something the Wachowskis came up with. Like, it is the Wachowski starship. And this weird, like, alien goddess woman pops up and goes, I'll send you back, but I'm gonna make you blind, and takes her sight, and then sends her back. This is the first episode, and you know what? The opening credits, like Netflix presents a Zalbat Mangley production starring Britt Marling, the OA, those opening credits appear 1 hour into the pilot, 10 minutes before the end of the show has a 1 hour cold open.
What the fuck? It's just, man, like Love Exposure.
Oh my God. No, you know, I think Love Exposure is a lot more clever than this.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking about Heaven's Story. No, what,
no. No, 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 no.
Scared the shit out of me for a second, guys. Don't do that. Flashbacks.
Oh, love God. Exposure. Love Exposure, TK. Much better movie.
Way better movie.
Anyway, here's the thing. After two episodes, even though I really dislike this show, I think that it is like chicken soup for the soul, and yet at the same time, it's like a show that they have these contrived lines, but they clearly think that if they whisper them, they will sound important and profound. Allow me to demonstrate. This is an actual line from the show. I thought that if I cast a beautiful net, I would only catch beautiful things. Man, trite. This is some trite nonsense. It's just no. But here's the thing. Here's why I'm going to watch this whole show. Because it seems to me that the fans of this show will never be satisfied, and they'll never be satisfied with my criticism if I don't see it through. You know? I really feel like this is one of those shows, because it is so clearly serialized and building towards some big ending. I feel like the people who love this show, if I say, no, I gave it a shot and I hated it, the first question is going to be, well, did you watch the whole thing? Because if you didn't watch the ending, then you didn't get the full story. So I'm probably going to finish it, but I'm going to take my sweet time because I am not in a rush. And I've read a few reviews that did not spoil the ending for me, but they said that the ending will make you hate that you watched the whole series. So we'll see. So that's the OA. I don't recommend it, but you know what? Some people seem to love it, and if it's your cup of tea, you go right ahead. I will finish the series. It's only 8 episodes, but it doesn't bode well. I'm not pleased.
I will say that pretentious line of dialogue you just said, if they actually had a fart sound after it in the actual show, then it would make the whole thing worthwhile.
They do not. They want you to take that stuff seriously. There's this whole monologue that Britt Marling gives about how you're only concerned with the visible you. The invisible you needs attention. Like, what does that even mean? So the other Netflix series that I've been watching, which is much better, is Netflix's A Series of Unfortunate Events. And I was a little skeptical going into this one, because I thought that the movie, A Series of Unfortunate Events, starring Jim Carrey in the Count Olaf role, I think that movie's great. I think that's a really awesome little movie. It's the best movie that Tim Burton didn't direct, because it has a real Tim Burton flair to it, but it is not Tim Burton. I think it's a perfectly good movie, and I was like, do we really need like an 8-to-10-part series from this? But guys, you know what? It's fantastic. I really like A Series of Unfortunate Events. Here, Neil Patrick Harris is playing the Count Olaf role, and he manages to be creepier than Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey was going for, like, the camp value, because Count Olaf is a failed actor. But Neil Patrick Harris, he genuinely comes off as, like, a creepy, creepy dude. And the way he turns on a dime between being this flamboyant star of the theater and, like, a genuinely menacing villain, it just makes him that much more unpredictable and scary. And it is the show, of course, since it's based on a series of novels, it does rehash some of the plot material from the movie. But, like, honestly, there's a whole plot line, and if you've seen the movie, you know about this, involving the Baudelaire orphans falling into Count Olaf's care. And he wants to get their family fortune, so he devises a plan to marry Violet, who is, I think she's only like 15 or 16, but he finds like a legal loophole where he can marry her and get her fortune. That is like one of 5 plots that goes on in the movie, which is like 2 hours long. But in the show, they just dedicate the first 2 episodes to it, so it's just like a 2-hour movie of that one plot line, and there was no point where I was like, oh, they added so much to this, or it's going on way too long. I think they've handled it really well. One of the more surprising decisions is casting Patrick Warburton as the character of Lemony Snicket, who's the narrator. In the movie, Lemony Snicket was played by Jude Law, but you only ever really saw him in shadow. And Jude Law's, you know, British accent gave the narration this very sort of like, oh, isn't it tragic, children heir? But Patrick Warburton, he's almost like doing like a Robert Stack kind of an impression, because his character is constantly saying like, the facts of the Baudelaire case are not to be underestimated. You know, he's like reviewing all the facts of their story. It's all extremely effective. The casting is all really good. I'm finding it totally charming. And so I give A Series of Unfortunate Events a big recommendation. I haven't read the books, so I don't know how much plot material there is, but this is the kind of thing where I kind of hope, like, we can get at least one more season out of it, because it's great. It's really fun.
From what I've heard, I haven't read the books either, but one of the biggest complaints I remember about the Jim Carrey movie is they said that they condensed, like, several books worth of plot lines into one movie, and I think that's what a lot of people are raving about the series, is now that you can spread it over several episodes, you can tell the story a lot better.
I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing what the show has in store. TK, do you know anything about the books?
I know they sell really well, but I've never picked them up myself, and that's all I've got.
Well, A Series of Unfortunate Events gets a big recommendation from me. And that is all I've been up to. So now is the part of the show where we'd usually do our batshit crazy movie countdown, and we have nominated some potential batshit crazy movies of 2017, but unfortunately none of them have release dates yet. So we'll start the countdown as soon as we know the release dates. But to recap, our three potential batshit crazy movies of 2017 at the moment are Best Friends, the movie where Greg Sestero and Tommy Wiseau, the stars and writer-director of The Room, are on a road trip together, and Tommy Wiseau is like a mortician, and he's smuggling gold in the mouths of corpses.
I think
a lot of potential there. The trailer is really something to behold, and boy, Wiseau's delivery is just as good as ever. Hey, I will help you out. Maybe I have a job for you. Get in. You know, like, just boy, oh boy. The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Now, not much is known about this one at the moment, but it's from Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of Dogtooth and the Lobster. And The Lobster won our Batshit Crazy Movie Award in 2015. So maybe Yorgos will deliver the goods again, and The Killing of a Sacred Deer will be yet another totally weird movie. And my nomination for Batshit Crazy Movie of 2017 is a movie called Bright, which is written by Max Landis. And it's a buddy cop movie where Will Smith and Joel Edgerton are cops. Oh, but Joel Edgerton plays an orc. Will Smith's partner's an orc. This is going to be amazing.
Be better than Collateral Beauty, at least.
Oh, boy. Time will tell. It's certainly a more interesting premise. I'll give it that one. So now let's talk about 2017. So when I sent off my notes about this podcast to you guys, I asked, like, what's the forecast? How do you guys feel going into 2017? Do you have high hopes for this year in the movies?
Maybe slightly better hopes than last year, but as I was looking over the release schedule, the first thing that came to my mind was, wow, there are so few original movies listed on here. Like, the vast majority of these are like sequels, remakes, reboots, continuations of a franchise, or like based on an existing property. And I was looking through it. I was like, there aren't that many that just stand out based on existing properties and stuff. So it just really struck me at just how safe this year is, that they're not taking any real chances in doing something original. They're all like going back to the well in 2017.
I had a similar thought as I was reviewing the release schedule for this year, but something occurred to me. I'm a big fan of the movie reviewer Movie Bob, and you should definitely check out his videos on YouTube. And he put together his list of his top 10 most anticipated movies of 2017. And at the beginning of it, he said something that really rang true, which is, we're right at the beginning of the year. The Oscars haven't happened yet. So the little festival films that are really going to shine, they're nowhere to be found at this point in time. You know, they may, like, the festival films that some people are talking about now, they might not even get released in 2017. So, something like I was thinking back on last year, and Robin, you and I both listed Swiss Army Man as our favorite movie of the year. Well, at the beginning of the year, none of us had any clue that that movie was a thing. It wasn't until we started hearing some festival buzz about this weird movie that we were really like, oh, this is interesting, and, you know, getting into it. Obviously, there are some exceptions to the rule, like Green Room, which was another favorite movie of ours, but we had been hearing about that one for like 2 or 3 years. So there are some exceptions to this, but I kind of feel like if it looks maybe a little bleak, like a year full of sequels and franchises, well, maybe that's just because we're at the start of the year, and that's the kind of movie, that's the big blockbuster movie that gets advertised this early. TK, do you have any thoughts on, like, the forecast of 2017?
Yeah, like you guys, I saw it as a year full of a lot of repetition and a lot of sequels. But as opposed to last year, where there were a whole bunch of sequels I don't feel we needed or really wanted to see, this year I have a lot more positive feelings towards the sequels that are coming out. I'll talk about a bunch of them later on, but there's a bunch of films that I'm actually really excited to see this year that are sequels and that are sequels, regardless of how I feel about the original franchise. I'm still interested in continuing it. So that's I'm hoping to go into 2017 with a little more upbeat attitude on what's coming out.
You know, I'm with you actually. There are a lot of sequels I want to see. But I only put one on my list. I only allowed myself one. And that being said, this is one of those years, you know, we've talked in the past on this podcast about how the movie release cycle, it is very cyclical, you know, like we got a Coen Brothers movie last year, so we're not going to get one this year, but we didn't get a Christopher Nolan movie last year, so we're going to get one this year. So, there are filmmakers that we haven't seen in a little while that are putting out movies this year, and I'm looking forward to them on that alone. Anyway, enough dilly-dallying. Let's talk about some of these movies. And Robin, why don't you start us off with your number three, your third most anticipated movie of 2017?
Well, this is a sequel that I'm actually really looking forward to, and that's because the original film was just such a pleasant surprise, and that's Kingsman: The Golden Circle. I still remember when the original Kingsman came out 2 years ago, and I just really didn't have much anticipation for it because it had such a generic title, and it looked like a knockoff of a Bond film, and didn't seem like anything special. But the movie was just amazing and one of the most entertaining action films of the last couple years, and I seem to remember that my most anticipated movie that year was Spectre, but Kingsman turned out to be a way better Bond film than Spectre was. So I'm actually really looking forward to seeing the sequel, just because this is a franchise that is still relatively fresh and hasn't really gone on too long, and I'm really anxious to see what they're going to do with it. And what I like about this one is that they're sending the characters over to America, and it has like a amazing cast. Like they team up with like the Statesman, which is the American Secret Agent Society, and it's headed by Jeff Bridges in this one, which is quite amazing. And it also has Channing Tatum as an American agent, and Halle Berry and Julianne Moore. So and apparently Colin Firth is coming back. I have no idea how they're going to do it since he was killed in the original one, but it'll be great to see him back because he turned out to be an amazing action hero in Kingsman. And I'm also looking forward to seeing Taron Egerton, who was an actor I had never heard of before Kingsman, but he was a very likable leading man, and I loved his chemistry with Mark Strong, and I want to see them come back. So I would kind of like to see Kingsman become like a recurring series like the Bond franchise, where it kind of parodies it but becomes like an amazing action film at the same time. So yeah, this is probably one of the sequels that I'm most looking forward to.
Kingsman is in my honorable mentions, but I am definitely curious about it for all the reasons that you mentioned there, especially Colin Firth coming back. Like, is he going to be like a robot, or maybe is he going to be evil? You immediately start thinking of like all the Bond tropes and going like, oh, how could they do that? You know, they brought back 006 in GoldenEye and turned him into a bad guy. Are they going to do the same thing here? something that I really loved about the first Kingsman movie is that it was, you know, it was at once parodying and paying homage to Bond films, but it was parodying and paying homage to not, like, the good Bond films. It was, like, parodying the Roger Moore and, like, the, well, TK might skewer me for saying this, but the Timothy Dalton Bond films as well.
You be careful. Careful here.
The secondary, the lesser Bond films, not the Connery Bond films in particular, you know. Connery is held up as the best Bond, but it seemed like Kingsman was going for the ultra-violent version of a Roger Moore Bond film. And so I'm really curious to see what they do with the sequel, because it's sort of like, well, where do you go from here? You know, they parodied it and paid homage to it so beautifully. Do they need to say more? I hope they have more to say. So yeah, I'm really
curious. Interesting. One thing I just thought of is just that even though it technically had a happy ending, the world is in pretty bad shape at the end of Kingsman, because like they blew up like all the heads of all these world leaders and there was mass violence. So it's like millions of people probably got killed, including some of the world's biggest leaders. So I would kind of like to see them acknowledge it, where the sequel starts off in a really bad place where the world's in bad shape because of the destruction at the end of the last Kingsman. So I think there are many fun ways they can go here.
Well, and you kind of wonder, like, are they going to pull a Bond trick? Because, you know, Bond, there's very little continuity between the movies, so are they even going to bother acknowledging it? Are they going to ignore it, or are they going to acknowledge it? That's a question that that is enough to get me to buy a ticket, just to see if they answer that one. TK, Kingsman, The Golden Circle, is it on your list?
No, actually. Although this is my anticipated best use of Channing Tatum in a film award for 2017. Because I think he's going to be great as an American King. Be great. I was so blown away, surprised by the first one that I hope the second one can at least match up the expectation I got for it now. But from the cast listing alone, I think it's going to be great.
Do we know if Matthew Vaughn is directing this?
Yes, he is.
All right, that gives me some hope. You know, when I think of like an ultra-violent Matthew Vaughn sort of homage parody film, I think of Kick-Ass, and I loved Kick-Ass when it came out. But Kick-Ass 2, it didn't get Matthew Vaughn back, and it was really nowhere near as good. So it's reassuring that Matthew Vaughn is back in the director's chair. TK, what's your number 3?
So I'm going to preface this by saying that any big, huge blockbuster or film that I've raved on in the past is absent from my list. I worked very hard to try to make sure that my list wasn't going to be like big, obvious movies like John Wick or like anything like that. I kept a lot of them off my list. So my list is going to be a little different than I think your two are going to be. So my number 3 most anticipated film of the year is Free Fire, which has a trailer out now. It's a new film. It's an action film directed by Ben Wheatley, which stars Brie Larson, Shatira Copley, Armie Hammer, and Cillian Murphy. And it's about a bunch of people who have gotten together in a warehouse to like trade and buy guns, and they get into this massive shootout and firefight. And it looks like a lot of fun. I was kind of entranced by the trailer when I first saw it, and I've just been looking forward to it ever since. My anticipation hasn't really gone anywhere for it, and I just really want to see, after watching Cillian Murphy play a mob guy in the 20s on Peaky Blinders, I kind of want to see him play a modern-day gunslinger. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
In the 70s, no less, with a big mustache.
I know. It's going to be great. I'm hoping this is like the nice guys for this year, but... you know, all I can do is hope. And it is being distributed by A24, which is a studio I have a huge amount of respect for. So I can, all I can do is hope that that continues from here.
Well, they put out Swiss Army Man, I believe. So
yes, they did.
They're right in my good books.
Yeah, as well they should be.
I've been hearing about Free Fire since last summer because it was at the Toronto International Film Festival. And out of the festival, it was getting like sort of mixed reviews. It wasn't like leaning one hard one way or hard the other. It seemed like some people really enjoyed it and some people weren't too keen on it. But frankly, the very concept of Ben Wheatley directing an hour and a half long gunfight, that's enough for me. I'm very curious. And the trailer is loaded with style. I think this will probably give John Wick 2 a run for its money in terms of like best shootout, because I guess the whole movie's a shootout. So, especially after getting way into Ben Wheatley this year, and like, I watched Kill List, and I watched, Downview Terrace, his first film, and I went to this Skype Q&A with him at the Royal Cinema. After getting into his works, I'm really curious to see what he does with some big name actors and a bigger budget and just a whole lot of guns. Free Fire is also in my honorable mentions. Robin, have you heard of this one?
Yes, I did. I haven't seen the trailer for it, but I read about it this afternoon, and I was really intrigued when they said that the whole movie was a shootout, and just the idea that last year's Best Actress winner, Brie Larson, you're putting in a movie where she's in a shootout the whole time. I thought that was pretty cool, just seeing this pretty talented cast together with this premise, and I still have officially never seen a Ben Wheatley film, so this might be a good introduction to him.
Kill List, guys. I'll reiterate it. I've said it before, I'll say it again. You both need to watch Kill List. I think it is fantastic British thriller material. But Free Fire does look like a darn good time. And you know what? It has one of my favorite posters that I've seen in a long time. It just has a fantastic poster where all these arms wielding guns are just sort of like popping out of the poster at you. It's really great, and I encourage people to look it up. So my number three... Now, TK, I found it interesting that you said, like, you wanted to leave off the big-budget movies, and you think that your list is going to be very different than mine and Robin's, because I imposed a rule on myself, which is that I would only allow one, like, sequel in my list, because we're just going to be inundated with sequels. We've been talking about, you know, there's just endless sequels coming out this year, so this is the one that I am most looking forward to. And that is Blade Runner 2049. Now, the premise of a belated sequel to Blade Runner is audacious at best and terrible at worst. And Ryan Gosling in the lead role, you know, that could be a really bum move. But it's being directed by Denis Villeneuve. And after seeing Denis Villeneuve's take on sci-fi with Arrival, and having seen his movie Enemy, which portrays the city of Toronto as this very, like, dystopic, industrial city that it is perpetually bathed in pallid yellow light, I feel like this is a really good fit between the material and the director. And it's my hope that the only reason they are making Blade Runner 2049 is because somebody had a damn good idea worth putting on screen. Like, what is the point of making a Blade Runner sequel at this point in time if nobody had a great idea to support it? Now, on top of that, it's got a few returning players. You know, Ridley Scott is producing it. Harrison Ford is reprising his role as Deckard, which is interesting. Does that mean he's a replicant or not? Are they even going to bother addressing it? I hope they don't. But there is one name on this that has just got me, hook, line, and sinker. That's Roger Deakins behind the camera. If you've seen the trailer, oh my god, this movie looks great. It already looks just fantastic. And I can't wait to see Deakins take on the world of Blade Runner. Especially now that it's had time to, like, gestate in everybody's minds. I've read, and I don't know exactly how true this is, but I've read that originally Blade Runner was not, it was like maybe a modest success, but it wasn't a big hit. And over the years, it has grown into this masterpiece of sci-fi cinema. So I'm just really curious to see what they're going to do with this. But you know, man, that trailer looks great. Like, that trailer, to me, sells it really well. After watching it, I was like, you know what? This doesn't feel as unnecessary as I thought it would. So Blade Runner 2049 does get my vote.
Yes, I am actually surprised. It's not on my top three, but I'm actually surprised that I am looking forward to this. And I think you got the point down where you say that they would not have done this like so many years after the fact if they did not have a good idea for it. And just the fact that Harrison Ford has agreed to come back back, because he has said many times that he did not even like being in Blade Runner. Like, it's one of his least favorite films he's done. So it's like, for him to agree to reprise his role as Deckard, I mean, that it just shows that there must be something there that compelled him to come back all these years. So I do have high hopes for it. I think it's going to look great. It has a terrific cast. And as much as you can say about Ryan Gosling, I think he would fit into this world very well. Like, maybe they'll make it ambiguous if he's a replicant or not, because even watching some of his performances and stuff like Drive, you kind of get the sense that, hey, this guy kind of seems like a replicant, because he always plays these characters that are kind of like low on emotion and stuff. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with that, but I think he'll fit in well. And I'm excited to see Dave Bautista in a Blade Runner movie and stuff. He's one of those guys now where I'm just excited to see him in a movie, because he's transitioned so well from wrestling to cinema. So I kind of see him being in like the Leon role from the original Blade Runner. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. So yeah, I'm surprised by how anticipated I am for this.
Gosling looks great in his coat. Like, just the clothes they've put on him and the style they've applied, he looks fantastic. And here's something that you'll like almost never hear me say, but I kind of love that they cast Jared Leto in this film, because boy, he looks like a replicant, doesn't he? Doesn't he kind of look like he's made of plastic?
Yeah, it's true.
TK, do you have hopes for Blade Runner 2049?
Yeah, I was blown away by the initial trailer, and I am super excited to see it for almost entirely the reasons you gave, Gil. The camera work just in the trailer looks amazing, so I can only wait to see the whole film. It's going to be fantastic.
I mean, Villeneuve and Deakins, they collaborated so wonderfully on Sicario, and so I can't wait to see them get together again for something as visually stunning as the Blade Runner universe. Robin, what's your number two?
My number two I put on the list mainly because of who is directing it, and that's Baby Driver by Edgar Wright. And the main reason is that it has officially been 4 years now since Edgar Wright has released a finished film since The World's End, because as we all know, he was signed to do Ant-Man, but then left the production. So it'll be interesting to see him doing a kind of a British-American comedy drama now, because for the first time, he is not working with his usual people. He doesn't have Simon Pegg and Nick Frost in this. He's actually working with like A-list American actors like Jamie Fox and Kevin Spacey and John Hamm, which is intriguing. But I'm also intrigued by the fact that apparently he sent out a cryptic tweet last week where he implied that Meryl Streep might actually be in this movie, which they're being secretive about, which would be pretty amazing. And just reading about the premise of this, that it's about a getaway driver who helps people escape from heists, and that he always listens to music while he's doing it. And apparently all the action scenes in this movie are going to be timed to the songs he listens to. Like, they're going to be completely in sync. So he's trying something really new and unique for an action film. And I'm really anxious to see how he does this. There really isn't a lot of plot details about this, just the basic premise and who the cast members are. But it's Edgar Wright. What more can I say? I put him on my most anticipated films for 2013 for The World's End, and he did not disappoint. So I'm happy to see him back.
Baby Driver is my number one most anticipated movie of 2017. And I mean, I'm a diehard Edgar Wright fanboy, so of course this would wind up on my list. I love the idea of Edgar Wright doing a heist movie, like doing a riff on the movie Drive. I think that's a really great fit. But man, here's the selling point for me: Edgar Wright car chases. Wright has such a energetic and frenetic style, and like, his editing is so tight, and he so carefully chooses his shots, and he loves to use music really effectively. Like, if you watch the Cornetto trilogy of Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End, all three movies have just really amazing sequences that are synced up to music really well. Like, the synesthesia is on point in all of Wright's films. So just the draw of seeing him do a bunch of car chases all set to like really choice Edgar Wright music tracks, you got me. Like, I'm there. I am so there. And it will be really interesting to see him do another movie outside of his usual stable of actors. I loved Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. I know it wasn't a huge hit, but I'm happy to see that it's become a real cult film with a following in the years since it's been released. But I feel like, you know, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, those guys are great. I love it anytime they collaborate with Edgar Wright, but I'm always interested to see Wright step outside of that and, you know, take a few chances, work with some new people. And frankly, just the idea of John Hamm and Kevin Spacey being in an Edgar Wright movie, like, that's a great draw as well. So I am just like, I'm counting the minutes until we get a trailer for this one, because I see so much promise in the talent behind it, even though the details are pretty sparse at the moment. TK, have you heard of Baby Driver?
I have, and I hemmed and hawed about putting it on my list, but it's definitely in my honorable mentions. But I figured as soon as I saw Edgar Wright was putting a new movie, I'm certain it was going to be on your list, Gil.
Yeah, what a shock that Gil picked the Edgar Wright movie. TK, what's your number two?
So again, in a very non-shocking turn of events, my number two movie is a Luc Besson film, which shouldn't surprise anybody. But
I am
trailer...
actually surprised. I'm just going to say I'm surprised, but do
Why?
Go on.
Really? Why? Because
I'll let you describe it, and then I'll tell you why.
So Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets is based off of a French comic book that has these two kids essentially like space traveling, and it looks like The Fifth Element on crack. And I love that movie so much, and I am so interested in seeing it. I thought that the trailer for it looked beautiful, and I got more and more excited as it went on. And I've watched it about, 10 or 15 times since then. And each time, like, the anticipation hasn't gone away. And I'm just so excited on Luc Besson world building again. And I just think it's going to be fun. I don't even care about the storyline at this point. It just looks like a blast. And starring some unknown kids, which I think would be fun. And
not unknown? Dane DeHaan.
Yeah, okay. You're right.
And Suicide Squad's Cara Delevingne. Oh, no.
Oh, okay. Well, the less said about that, probably the better. But it's a Luc Besson movie. How can you not be excited about a new Luc Besson movie? I'm so pumped. Say what you will about Lucy. I had a good time watching it. This again, looks like a spiritual successor to The Fifth Element, and so I am in 100%.
Okay, here you go. So, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. I watched the trailer. I am there with you, you know. I like The Fifth Element. I think that this could be a lot of fun, and people are definitely saying, like, The Fifth Element, he's doing another thing like The Fifth Element, he's doing a crazy futuristic world, and it's full of aliens, and it's all brightly colored. But you know what this trailer kind of looked like to me? It looked just a little bit like Jupiter Ascending. I mean, can you deny it?
Yes, because Jupiter Ascending is made by the Wachowskis, and that movie was god-awful, terrible, and didn't star Eddie Redmayne. So nothing can ruin this for me.
Well, maybe so. But when I see a trailer for a big-budget sci-fi space opera in this vein that doesn't really have, like, a major pedigree behind it, or it doesn't... I immediately think of things like Jupiter Ascending or John Carter. And I should say, those are both movies that I really enjoyed, but I would not call either of them masterpieces, and I certainly would not say that either of those movies are anywhere near as good as The Fifth Element. So, I call me cautiously optimistic about Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which is kind of a confusing title as well. It's not the Planet of a Thousand Cities, it's the City of a Thousand Planets. Robin, what do you think of Valerian?
It's kind of funny. I had a feeling it would be on TK's list, but I had the same feeling while I was watching the trailer. This is very Jupiter Ascending-like, and I actually looked up the budget for it, and it's actually $180 million, and it certainly looks it, but I'm just surprised that they would invest that much money in it, because we've seen time and time again these lavish sci-fi epics that get these high budgets generally do flop and don't make their money back. I know Lucy was a surprise hit, but I'm kind of surprised they invested that much in Luc Besson, but of course I'm intrigued to watch.
Especially out the star power of Scarlett Johansson as well. I feel like a lot of Lucy's success can be attributed to her in the starring role.
That's true, yes. That kind of proved she was a draw when that movie made so much money, but I don't think any of the actors in here are definitely not proven draws. But I am intrigued to see it just from the trailer, where I have a feeling it might be something really cool. But I have a feeling that if it's bad, at least it will be memorably bad, because Luc Besson movies, for all their flaws, are rarely ever boring, so it should be an entertaining time. And it's got Rutger Hauer in it. I think that's kind of cool that the same year the Blade Runner sequel is coming out, we have Rutger Hauer in another big sci-fi epic, so that'll be cool.
Sure. Hey, I'd watch it. I mean, I'm going to watch it. Why not? $180 million budget, though. You know, that's almost as big a budget as Monster Trucks.
I still can't believe it had more than this one.
Did you know, this is tangential, but did you know that Monster Trucks was actually based off of an idea that a studio executive's 4-year-old kid had?
Wow. That's right. Then I'm going to throw $200 million at that. Okay.
Boy, oh boy. Anyway, time will tell on Valerian, but I'm very curious to see how this one shakes down, and I'm glad that I'm not alone in getting a Jupiter Ascending vibe off of it. So my number two, this is one that debuted at last year's Toronto International Film Festival. I've not seen it. A trailer dropped recently. It is a horror movie called Raw, and apparently this movie is so intense that people were fainting at the screening at TIFF. That is some... There's something going on here if a movie's actually making people pass out from fear or discomfort. The premise of Raw... It's not an English-language film. I can't remember offhand what country it hails from. But the premise is this woman is a vegetarian, and she decides to become a vet for animals. And so she goes to veterinary school, and she has to go through this like hazing ritual that the new students go through. And the hazing ritual seems to involve her consuming raw meat. She's got to like eat raw meat or drink animal blood. I don't know exactly what it entails, but she definitely ends up consuming some meat. And she develops this ravenous, carnivorous hunger for meat. But because she's a vegetarian, she decides that instead of eating animals, she's going to eat people. The trailer alone for this looks like one of the most intense and grotesque horror experiences in years. And I say that, like, this is clearly not just going for, like, you know, gorno, like, torture porn, overly gratuitous gore. It's obviously there's going to be gratuitous gore in it, but the trailer was shockingly artistic in its construction. I was watching it and I was going, like, my God, like, whatever twisted mind put this together, they had a vision for it, and that makes it all the more distressing. There were some laudatory quotes in the trailer that I especially love. One was disturbingly erotic. I'm like, oh man, there's a selling point. Put that right in the trailer. Disturbingly erotic. And then another one is packed to the brim with nightmare fuel. And I'm like, oh man, I just, like, that gets me excited, because I'm really curious. It seems like so many horror movies just sort of fall back on the same old tropes, and, you know, they, like, the Bye Bye Man. Like, who's friggin' scared of the Bye Bye Man? You know, you watch the trailer for that movie, and you laugh. But I watched the trailer for Raw, and, like, I was floored, and I had to watch it again, and I felt myself getting uncomfortable. It seems like this movie is going for body horror to a real extreme, including something that I've always thought should be in a horror movie, but I've never really seen it done quite the same way, and that's just the idea of, like, you develop an itch that is so uncontrollable that you end up scratching your skin off. There's all these scenes of, like, people scratching their skin off because they have this itch, and at one point, someone starts, like, peeling it off with scissors. Oh, my God! But at the same time, like, it feels like a horror movie that has substance. It seems like there is actually a story there. There's something that's going to make you want to continue watching it. And in a way, that's even more distressing. Have you guys heard of this? Robin, I know you're a horror movie fan. Have you heard of Raw?
No, heard of it. And oh my God, am I intrigued now, because people fainting at screenings, I haven't really heard anything like that since The Exorcist, which is about like 43 years ago. So this sounds pretty incredible, because it really gotten many of those movies, like horror movies released in North America, that can make you cringe. Like, generally they get like limited releases. Like, is Raw actually going to get like a theatrical?
It's coming out in theaters, that's for sure. I can't remember the date offhand, but I can definitely look it up. But the trailer has definitely, like, it's gone out with the promise that it's going to come out in theaters, even if it's just like a small release. It looks like March of this year is when it's going to come out. TK, have you heard of Raw?
Oh man, that trailer is gorgeous and brutal and uncomfortable. But I did the same thing you did, Gales. I watched it and then watched it again and then watched it again.
And every time you watch it, you feel more and more uncomfortable.
Yeah, but I couldn't stop. So, like, I'm really interested in seeing how this flick goes. This is on my honorable mentions list, and I was kind of hoping. I thought, actually, I'm amazed you haven't heard of it, Robin, because it sounds something that's a little up your alley, but I'm glad it's on yours, Gil.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear Robin's thoughts on the trailer after he watches it. So that brings us to Robin. What is your number one?
Well, I'm sorry, guys. I got to go with the obvious one because I can't help it. And now I'm going to go with Star Wars Episode 8, because I think I know you didn't like it as much as I did, Gil, but I think that Rogue One just got me in such a Star Wars mood that it's like I cannot wait to see like the next chapter, even though it's nothing to do with Rogue One. I just can't. The Wars movies have been such high quality, and this is the one that's, I think, going to show like the direction this series is going to go in. Everyone has talked about how like Episode 7 was done, like narrative wise is very similar to A New Hope, because they wanted to reintroduce Star Wars and get the fans familiarized with it as well, and be fat. You're giving them what they expect, and then to hit, you can start doing something different. Something Episode 8, because now they've reestablished themselves, and now Empire Strikes Back direction, like go in a place that's darker and maybe something more challenging. And I'm most looking forward to this because it's directed by Rian Johnson, who I never would have expected to do a Star Wars movie, and this is his first theatrical film since Looper, so I'm really anxious to see what he's going to do with it. And this is the one where we're finally getting Luke Skywalker coming back and getting the continuation of his and it's going to be pretty fascinating to see. And it's also going to have an extra level of poignancy to it, because now we know it's Carrie Fisher's last film role, so it's going to be kind of sad to see the last time, whatever happens, that you're going to see Princess Leia on screen, and a lot of other intriguing developments. Just the casting of Benicio del Toro, who's apparently playing a new villain in this one. Like, what's fun about these new Star Wars movies is you're seeing like so many actors that you would never expect to see in a Star Wars movie, like just like Benicio del Toro and Mads Mikkelsen and Ben Mendelsohn and Donnie Yen. Like, that's what's so exciting about these new Star Wars movies, and you know they're actually going to be interesting. It's not going to be like the prequels where George Lucas took a kind of made them boring. Here you're actually going to see amazing actors get to do interesting things potentially in a Star Wars movie. So, because this is pretty much the most anticipated film of the year overall, but it's still my number one most anticipated film for it. I just cannot wait to see it.
It's in my honorable mentions, and that's mainly because of what I said before. I only wanted to allow one sequel or blockbuster or remake into my list just to keep things fresh and interesting, because it would be so easy to even just do like part twos of movie franchises and just fill my list. But of course I'm looking forward to Star Wars. I mean, I may have liked Rogue One the least of the three of us, but it was still an entertaining movie, and like any gripes I have about it, I feel like just a big nerd every time I complain about it, because Star Wars, you know, it's just supposed to be fun, and ultimately Rogue One was a very fun time. But Rian Johnson is directing Star Wars Episode 8, and I love that guy. I love his work. Looper was my favorite film of that year. I have championed it where others have said it is stupid. So, I mean, I'm on board just based on the director alone. But like you said, Robin, we get to see Luke Skywalker on screen again, and I'm just, like, it's like a memorial now. It is in memoriam for Carrie Fisher, and I'm so curious to see her last movie, to see her on screen again, and to see what they do. Like, are they going to tie up her story? How are they going to conclude this? That's a question that I need an answer to, especially because Lucasfilm, after her death, came out and said, we're not going to CGI her. We're not going to do spoilers for Rogue One, but I feel like everyone knows now, we're not going to do what we did in Rogue One and, you know, CGI Leia's face onto someone else. Out of respect for Carrie Fisher, we are not going to do that. But that just leaves me wondering, so what are you going to do? Like, presumably, Episode 8, it must end on some kind of cliffhanger or something. Unless she dies in Episode 8 and that was always going to happen, they're going to have to do some mad scrambling to make sure that the continuity works. And I want to see it. I want to see what they do. It's going to be really fascinating. It's also just interesting to approach this movie without the anticipation of, like, oh, Star Wars is back after so long. Like, when The Force Awakens came out, it was such a big deal just because it had been so long since we'd even had good Star Wars movies. So now that that shine is gone, you know, now that, oh, we're just going to get all sorts of Star Wars movies from now on, it'll be very interesting going into this one, this part of the main saga. TK, you must be looking forward to Episode 8.
Yeah, I sure am. Considering how much I enjoyed The Force Awakens, I, of course, I'm looking forward to Episode 8, which I hear is going to be a bit darker and a bit more Empire-esque in its go for, which I am a huge fan of. So I'm really looking forward to see what they do with it and interested to see what they do with Leia, but I'm super excited to see Mark Hamill come back as Luke in this. It's going to be fantastic. As long as they don't end it with a really shitty helicopter shot like they did in Lost.
Oh, did that really bother you that much?
That really bothered me. You know why? Because the film looked so crisp and that last bit was like four resolution steps down from where it should be and just threw me off entirely. Like, sharpen it and do something, anything. It was just that.
It didn't bother me as much as it did you. So, as a side note, and I'm sure we will address this little thing, another, like, tangential thought that I had, but I'm sure we'll address when we see Star Wars Episode 8, but don't you guys find it interesting that The Empire Strikes Back has become shorthand for just, like, a good sequel with a dark ending? Like, everything now, part two is going to be like The Empire Strikes Back of this franchise. And I find it funny that now we're getting another, like, middle movie in a Star Wars trilogy, and everybody's going, like, this is going to be The Empire Strikes Back of Star Wars.
I kind of wonder if they're just going to go something different just to shock us. Like, it'll end with, like, a musical number or something like that.
Oh, the Ewoks are coming back. It's going to be an Ewok-centric movie directed by Rian Johnson. You know,
yes,
I'd watch
awesome.
That. Who am I kidding? I would be so on board.
It's true. And another tangential thing I want to mention, I looked up Benicio del Toro's filmography, and I find it ironic that the next movie he's doing after Star Wars is a movie called The Trap. So I hope that Admiral Akbar says that line to him throughout the movie some point.
I'm still waiting for Akbar, a Star Wars story, the Admiral Akbar origin movie, where all throughout it, he keeps almost saying it's a trap. He says it's a sabotage. It's sabotage. It's an ambush. And then right before the credits goes, it's a, and then the end credits. I'm waiting for it. All right, TK, what's your number one?
So my number one is a film that I heard about late last year, and the trailer actually dropped for it this week, and it looks really kind of menacing. And the film is called The Discovery, and it stars Rooney Mara, Jason Segel, Robert Redford, and Jesse Plemons. And the premise upon it is that the afterlife has been verified to exist. It's a real thing. So what happens is a whole bunch of people kill themselves to get there. And this takes place a year after that discovery. And it looks like Rooney Mara and Jason Segel play this couple who get involved in like trying to figure out what's like why people are doing it or what it's like. And it just, it looks have you guys, please tell me you guys have seen the trailer for this. Either of you?
I haven't watched it yet, but I'm aware of this movie for sure. I know you and I talked about it before. I just haven't had a chance to watch the trailer, but the premise alone is very interesting.
The premise is fascinating, and Robert Redford being in this as well really intrigued me, but I really like Jason Segel doing semi-dramatic stuff. Like he impressed me so much in the end of the tour last year that I really look forward to him doing stuff that's not his usual comedy. So I like him approaching this stuff because I think he's really, really talented. And the premise is creepy, but God, the trailer makes it look so atmospheric and so unsettling. And it hit every note for me, like this weird sci-fi philosophical look at this. And I'm really excited for it. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting film to sit back and watch. And I'm not quite sure what else to say about it because you guys haven't seen the trailer. I really want to talk about it more, but I want to let you guys take it in on your own because it looks like a lot of fun. And that's my number one anticipate. I can't wait to see this movie.
It's Netflix produced, right?
Yes, it is.
I mean, I'm always on board for Netflix programming. They tend to put out really good stuff. I mean, my opinions on the OA aside, I still appreciate that series exists. And I really like all the stuff that Netflix has been doing. So, I would watch this blind. Like, I would watch it without even having seen the trailer, just based on the premise and the cast and the talent behind it.
You're seeing a list of movies that were set to come out in 2016, and I remember reading about this premise. I think it was just kind of on the undecided. They didn't know when it was going to come out, only that the project had been greenlit. But it's coming back to me now. I remember seeing that and seeing what an unusual cast, but it is finally coming out, and that it'll be easily accessible on Netflix.
So my number one is Baby Driver, as I mentioned, but I'll take this opportunity to talk about a bunch of my honorable mentions. And here's one that just barely missed making my list. It's a film called Get Out, and it is directed by Keegan-Michael Key of Key and Peele. And I really find this one interesting. This is another one that wound up on Movie Bob's Most Anticipated Movies of the Year list. And the way he described it puts it so perfectly. He says, it's the Stepford Wives, but with racism instead of the patriarchy. It's about this young man, this young black man, who is dating this white girl, and they go to visit her family, and her family lives in sort of a gated community, and the young man, who is played by Daniel Kaluuya, who I really like, ever since I saw him in the TV series The Fades, I've liked him, and he popped up on Black Mirror, and he's been in some other stuff as well, but so he goes to this community to visit his girlfriend's parents and quickly notices that all the black people in this community are, you know what? Sorry, let me just backtrack a little bit. I said Keegan-Michael Key, but it was Jordan Peele. Jordan Peele directed it, not Keegan-Michael Key. The other half of Key and Peele. Anyway, he visits this community and all the black people in this community are just like these placid servants. They're really just happy to be of service and happy to help out all the white people. And it seems like there might be almost like a Most Dangerous Game element of it, involving hunting the main character. The trailer is great. The trailer is like really eerie and weird. And it seems like just a fresh take on an interesting kind of like body snatcher horror movie. So if I had to pick a number four, it would be Get Out. Again, written and directed, my apologies, by Jordan Peele, not by Keegan-Michael Key. Have you guys seen the trailer for this one?
I haven't seen the trailer, but I saw it on the list of summaries today, and it sounds pretty interesting to me. I'll definitely be checking it out.
Yeah, this is another one that I think you'll really appreciate the trailer for. It seems like one of those movies that's built on a great premise, and it wouldn't take a high budget to pull it off. And those always impress me. Like, it doesn't seem like this is a movie that will need a lot of special effects to be a great horror movie. So I'm definitely intrigued. And again, huge shout out to Daniel Kaluuya. I love this guy, and he was in Sicario. I should note that as well. I just, every time he pops up, I'm happy to see him, and it all goes back to when I first saw him in this far too underrated series called The Fades that aired in 2011. So a big recommendation for The Fades, go Daniel Kaluuya, and I can't wait to see Get Out. Robin, what are some of your honorable mentions?
Well, one movie that was almost considered for the countdown, but more anticipated ones is Kong Skull Island, because, and it's mainly on the basis of that trailer, because first I thought, oh, they're rebooting King Kong again, like it's only been 10 years since the last one, and then saw, well, it has a pretty interesting cast, maybe I'll give it a shot, and then it has this trailer where it starts off serious, and then you get John C. Reilly on there, and it just becomes really goofy, and I just have no idea, like, what this is supposed to be, but I'm anticipating to see it just because I have no idea where it's going to go. So quite excited for that one for all the wrong reasons, I think.
Yeah, I'm totally intrigued just because I think it's going to be a hot mess of a movie. I mean, it's being released in like March, so at the like before the big blockbusters really start coming out, and it just looks so weird on a tonally so strange.
And I'm also looking forward to War of the Planet of the Apes. Like, this was a series where I did not expect to be as excited about it as when it came out, but, like, it just has gradually gotten better. Like, Rise of the Planet of the Apes was so much better than expected, and Dawn was even better, and War, which is actually going to show the details of the war between the humans and the apes, is probably going to be amazing. Like, if there's one flaw of the series I've found so far is that they're not as great as at introducing, like, interesting human characters. I've always found the human characters to be a bit bland, but just Andy Serkis as Caesar is just so amazing, and the way that they've built up the world of the apes and how they've evolved is just been so incredible and so incredibly well done, and now we get to see the climax to see like how they finally took over the earth. So definitely looking forward to that one.
And it's got Woody Harrelson, and right in the trailer, he finally pulls that trick where he says the title of the movie, but it's just a little bit off, where he says it'll be a planet of apes.
Yes. It's pretty cool about the series is because, like, none of the original Planet of the Apes sequels, which showed how, like, they took over the Earth, were really that good, but now that they've rebooted it, they've acted depicting it so much better than they did before. So very wise choice here. They've done very well with this premise. And of course, I'm looking forward to Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Like, even though we've got like so many superhero and comic books, this is the one I'm most looking forward to just because we've only had one of these before and it was just so much better than expected. And I really want to get back with these characters, and I thought the trailer for it was hilarious. So it'll definitely, I think, out of all the comic book movies that come out this year, be the one that feels the most fresh.
Yeah, I'm totally on board. Awesome Mix Volume 2 is going to, I already know I'm just going to be listening to that soundtrack over and over again. And it's such a fun, like, retro, colorful, groovy kind of sci-fi movie. Yeah, I can't wait.
And also, I see there's another Cloverfield movie coming out called, I think, God's Particle and stuff, and I know the details about it are very vague, and that they didn't intend it to be part of the Cloverfield anthology, but since 10 Cloverfield Lane became one of the most unexpectedly good movies, pleasant surprises that came out last year, I'm actually looking forward to see how this one turns out.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. Always intrigued by these Cloverfield movies.
Yep. And also, John Wick Part 2, I don't know why they're making a sequel to John Wick, but the first one was just such a pleasant surprise that I'm really looking forward just to see Keanu Reeves shoot people for like an hour and a half again. What's funny about it is that the original film had such a simple premise where his car is destroyed and his dog is killed and he just wants to go and kill everybody for it. So I'm anxious to see like what flimsy for the sequel or something. It's like somebody destroys like his piano or something like that, and Keanu Reeves decides to go on a shooting rampage. I'm just anxious to see what flimsy plot they put to it, but it's gonna, if the action scenes are good, then that's all that really matters. I'm looking forward to it because of how much fun the original movie was.
I noticed in the trailer that he has a new dog. I kind of wonder if that dog is gonna die and set him off again.
Yes, yes, that'll be hilarious if it's pretty much the exact same movie, but it doesn't really need to be anything too complex.
Yeah, when it comes and to John also, Wick, it can just be whatever, it can just be that again, and it'll be fun.
Yep. Yep, it doesn't really need all that much. And I am strangely looking forward to The Fate of the Furious. I didn't know if they needed to make any more Fast and the Furious movies because Paul Walker died, but the movies just get goofier and more fun the more of them they make, so I'm looking forward to this one, and mostly because they got Helen Mirren to agree to appear in this. Like, you're losing Paul Walker, but you're gaining Helen Mirren. That's a pretty fair trade-off, so as long as it produces more goofy fun, then I will continue to go see these movies, because they make more and more money as the more of them they make, so it's such a cash cow that I kind of look forward to them every few years.
And, you know, I'm looking forward to them now as well, because as listeners of this podcast know, after Furious 7 became one of the best reviewed movies of the year of its release, I had to see what the big deal was, and I watched all of the Fast and Furious movies. And I gotta say, for the most part, they didn't impress me, but parts 6 and 7 were just amazing. They just went so wacky, over the top, off the rails, that I'm pretty excited to see The Fate of the Furious as well. However, talk about a missed opportunity. Why isn't it F8? Why? Because it's the 8th movie. Why isn't it The Fate of the Furious? I don't know why they didn't do that. They totally should have.
That's too bad. Yeah, they should have done that. But I really want to see a scene of Helen Mirren driving a car off a cliff and then body surfing on it. That'll be the worth the price of admission alone if they put that scene in it.
Yeah, I'm so on board.
Yeah. And yeah, those are pretty much my most anticipated ones.
TK, what are some of your most anticipated movies?
Oh, man, I've got a mess of them. Ones that Robin talked about that I'm super looking forward to. I really want to see John Wick. Really want to see Guardians of the Galaxy. More importantly, I really want the soundtrack. Sorry, I had other stuff here. Okay, I really need to see Logan. The second trailer dropped today, and it looks so much better than I ever could have dreamed it could be.
It looks really good. Logan's on my list as well.
This is just for me, but I really want to see Alien Covenant.
I actually forgot that movie was coming out.
Yeah, and watching the trailer, it looks an awful lot like Prometheus, but I liked Prometheus, so that's
well. And I mean, I know you liked Michael Fassbender in Prometheus, and now you're getting twice the Michael Fassbender. He's playing a dual role, so you get double Fassbender,
and it's perfect. It's just perfect.
I'll totally see that. By the way, I want to say that for all I'm like, yeah, it could be good. I'm still gonna see it.
I also really want to see the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie because, wow, now I've forgotten the name of the guy playing the bad guy.
Javier Bardem.
Yeah, he looks like he's having fun, and I'm okay with that. And I enjoy that franchise enough that I'm willing to overlook flaws because I just think they're fun to watch. And I think they look fantastic, and the teaser for this didn't look any different. So I'm hoping that that continues from here. I am intrigued in Dunkirk, the new Christopher Nolan film. I think it's going to be really, really well done. And again, there's my Cillian Murphy film.
Twice the Cillian Murphy this year.
I also really want to see Darkest Hour, which is a drama pic about Winston Churchill on the eve of World War II. And Churchill's played by,
Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman. And he looks great. And Ben Mendelsohn plays plays King George V, and just it looks real. And John Hurt is playing Neville Chamberlain, and it looks really interesting. And the production pictures I've seen, the makeup looks fantastic. So I'm looking forward to that as well. It's another Marvel movie, but I really want to see Thor Ragnarok, and I've wanted to see that since the second Thor movie dropped, and I am very excited for this, especially with the crossover and the Doctor Strange flick. I'm super excited to see if Cumberbatch makes an appearance in this one.
and being directed by Taika Waititi, who we mentioned before, the director of Hunt for the Wilder People and What We Do in the Shadows. I think that he's going to bring a really interesting sense of humor to the Thor movies that hasn't been there already. So I'm looking forward to that one, too.
And the last one I have is there's a film coming out called What Happened to Monday, and it stars, hang on a second, I actually don't have the cast list here in front of me, and I'm sorry for that. But the premise looks really interesting. So Willem Dafoe, Glenn Close, and Noomi Rapace is set in a not-so-distant future burdened by overpopulation where a global one-child-per-family policy has happened. Seven identical sisters play a cat-and-mouse existence pretending to be a single person to elude the Child Allocation Bureau. That's kind of cool.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's going to be Netflix-produced, and I think it's going to come out late in the year, but it looks really interesting. So Netflix is killing it for me this year. And I think that those are all my honorable mentions, unless I've missed something.
Well, guys, I think that this is actually, this gives me a lot of hope because I still have movies in my honorable mentions that you guys haven't mentioned yet. And, there are a lot of really interesting ones here. So I'll start off by saying this year could potentially have some really terrific Michael Shannon performances in it. There are two movies that he's in that I really want to see. One is called The Shape of Water, and it is directed by Guillermo del Toro. And we don't really have much to go on yet, except this like one-sentence plot summary from IMDb. An otherworldly story set against the backdrop of Cold War-era America circa 1963. So we're getting like supernatural Cold War stuff. It's listed as a drama fantasy romance from Guillermo del Toro, starring Michael Shannon, Octavia Spencer, Doug Jones, Michael Stuhlbarg, and Richard Jenkins. Sign me up. Great cast. And if you look at the poster for it, which is on IMDb, and TK, I encourage you to do so especially, it has got a serious BioShock vibe to it. So I'm really interested to see even just the first trailer for this one.
Sorry, what's it called, Gil? I missed that.
The Shape of Water. Guillermo del Toro's back. And the other Michael Shannon one that I'm really interested in seeing, there's barely anything to go on with this, but it's called Pottersville. And the premise is that Michael Shannon, he's a local businessman in a small town. One night, he gets drunk and dresses up in a gorilla costume and goes on like a drunken rampage through town. And the whole town thinks that he's Bigfoot. And this media firestorm happens in the town where everybody thinks that Bigfoot is there. Co-starring Ian McShane, Ron Perlman, Christina Hendricks, and Judy Greer. Yes, please. Michael Shannon is Bigfoot. Gimme, gimme, gimme.
What's hilarious is that Judy Greer is also playing an ape in War of the Planet of the Apes as well.
So true. But man, oh man, I just think that this just sounds hilarious to me, and I can't wait to see it.
I'm also wondering if there's any significance to the title because Pottersville is the name of the alternate. Yeah, It's a Wonderful Life. So I wonder if there's going to be some sort of weird homage to it or something.
I'm so intrigued. I mean, this sounds great. Other films I'm looking forward to. The Lost City of Z was getting a lot of buzz out of TIFF and some other festivals. I don't know much. It stars Charlie Hunnam. It's being produced by Brad Pitt. And it's based on, like, the true story of this explorer, exploring through the jungles. And the main thing that has me intrigued, because, you know, the trailer looks okay, but the real hook for me is that, without fail, all the reviews I've read have said this harkens back to, like, the Indiana Jones movies of yore. This is the adventure film that has been sorely lacking in theaters for years. And I think that Charlie Hunnam is sort of a prime candidate to play an Indiana Jones-type character. So I'm really looking forward to this one. I'm very curious.
And it's actually based on a true story, like one of the most kind of infamous disappearances of all time, because you had this Indiana Jones-like explorer who just disappeared into the jungle and was never found. So I'm interested to see, like, if they kind of fictionalize it or if they stick to the real story. But that's kind of interesting that you have this action hero who does not come to a good end. I wonder if they're going to try to come up with a story to explain what happened to him.
It's got great reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, so I'm real curious. And there are more. I'm shocked, guys, that neither of you mentioned the untitled Paul Thomas Anderson movie that is listed as coming out this year. The only information we have on this is that it is a drama set in the fashion world of London in the 1950s, and of course it stars Daniel Day-Lewis.
I mean, oh, I didn't know about this one. Oh my god!
Yeah, do you need more than that? This is, I think this will be really interesting. No matter what he does, Paul Thomas Anderson always delivers something very, very unusual and artful and cool. And it'll be really neat to see him take on the world of fashion, just with his incredible, you know, cinematography that he's really known for as well. So.
Because I've found, like, the last two films of his, Inherent Vice and The Master, to be disappointments, but if he's reuniting with Daniel Day-Lewis, then that's all that needs to be said.
Yeah, and I should say, too, that I wasn't super keen on The Master, and I definitely wasn't really keen on Inherent Vice, but I still think both of those movies are really well made, and they look really terrific. And, I mean, fashion is all about the looks, so Daniel Day-Lewis in a fashion movie, I mean, that in and of itself is pretty great. Let's see here. We talked about all those Marvel movies that actually look pretty good. Related, you know, bouncing off of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, there's another James Gunn movie coming out this year called The Belko Experiment. Have you guys heard of this one?
Yes, I have. Yes.
So the
that was my runner up for most batshit crazy film of the year.
Yes, that's right. Battle Royale meets Office Space. I've seen the trailer. Looks pretty good. I'm looking forward to that one. Dane DeHaan, I guess, is going to have quite the year because he's starring in Valerian and The City of Thousand Planets, but he's also starring in this movie called A Cure for Wellness that has got me very curious. The premise is that he's like the young vice president, I think it is, of some big corporation, and the CEO has gone missing at this weird, like, Swiss retreat. And so Dane DeHaan is sent to go and get the CEO. But of course, this retreat is like a sinister asylum and everybody's being sedated and being fed hallucinatory drugs. It looks like sort of a mashup of Altered States and Shutter Island, which is a mashup that I can get behind. The one thing that is holding me back from being totally on board, though, is that it's being directed by Gore Verbinski. And that guy's track record is a really mixed bag, especially after, like, The Lone Ranger? I don't know about that. But the trailers look great. Like, the visuals in this movie look pretty astounding. Man, and as an aside, I really hate the new trailer trend of just calling every director visionary. I watched the trailer for A Cure for Wellness, and it said, from visionary director Gore Verbinski. And I went, really? Visionary? I don't know about that, man. From the director of three Pirates of the Caribbean movies and the remake of The Ring, and he's a visionary?
Well, but, he did do Mouse Hunt, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, he did do Mouse Hunt. Well, that's good. But all that being said, the trailers look great. Like, it looks like a really cool, psychological, trippy horror movie. So I'm on board for that one. You know, cautiously optimistic, I guess. And the last one I want to mention... that, like, I hope it's good. And I want this to be a case, I want this to be the same case as what I anticipate from Blade Runner 2049. I want this to be a case of somebody having a, like, great idea and reuniting people because of that. And that's Trainspotting 2. I really like the trailer for Trainspotting 2. But it's a belated sequel. It's 20 years old. And to Trainspotting, like, does that movie demand a sequel? Here's the thing. If it wasn't all the original cast returning, with Danny Boyle directing, and based on a sequel novel by the same author, I wouldn't be interested. But because it is literally the entire gang back making this movie, I am intrigued. I hope it'll be good. But it seems like it has a lot of potential to not be good. I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on Trainspotting 2?
I mean, it theoretically, it's done everything right. Like, it has all the original cast back, and it's not, like, written from scratch. It's based on a novel, but it's, like, so many of the 20-years-plus sequels that have come out recently just have been so unnecessary, such as Independence Day 2 and some of the weird sequels like Bad Santa do. It just seems like a bizarre project to turn back, and I always find it kind of amusing that, like, all these characters, or at least most of them, were heroin addicts, and here we are like 20 years later, and they're all still alive, which is kind of unrealistic almost, but hey, if the original cast came back, it could have potential.
I mean, the trailer opens with a fantastic line where, you know, Mark walks into a bar where, oh, what's his name? It's Johnny Lee Miller's character.
Sick Boy,
yeah, where Sick Boy is shooting pool. Sick Boy looks up and goes, "Hello, Mark. What have you been up to for 20 years?" Like, that's a good line. So, I don't know. I hope for the best, but I certainly don't expect it. TK, do you have any thoughts on Trainspotting 2?
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about it yet. I've watched the trailer a few times, and I don't know. Like, have faith in Danny Boyle, my son, but just, I'm not sure.
It's based on, is what, Irvin Welsh, was that his name?
Irvin Welsh, yeah.
Yeah. It's based on his novel, you know.
His stuff is great. So, and if he had any involvement in the screenplay writing, I'll be way more behind it. But because I don't know, that's where I'm at. On the fence.
Very curious about this one. Well, we'll find out pretty soon, because it's coming out in March. So those are my honorable mentions. And now let's ask the really important question. What movie do you guys think is going to be the worst movie of 2017 or the biggest flop?
Well, the movie that just made me scratch my head when I heard it was coming out is the Emoji Movie. Like, my God, we're making movies about emoji. I mean, the only thing that kind of got my attention is how they recently cast Patrick Stewart to do the voice of Poop Emoji. It's like, well, if yeah, seriously, I saw that as a headline the other day. Patrick Stewart is the voice of Poop Emoji. His name is Poop Daddy. That's his character. I mean, if Patrick Stewart agreed to do it, then maybe there's potential, and at the very least, he'll make his part, like, entertaining and stuff, but it's kind of like, this is just such a trend. It's like, 10 years from now, people might look back at this movie and go, like, what the fuck? Like, what is this movie even based on? It's like, it's just taking, like, a trend and basing an entire movie around it for no reason, and it's like, it could flop very badly, but hopefully maybe Patrick Stewart will guide it towards something good, but I don't know.
Patrick Stewart, he's going to be talking shit.
Exactly.
Oh my God. This is too much.
Yeah. Will you guys see it just for that reason? Because I kept thinking that. Okay.
I have no interest in it. I never saw the Angry Birds movie, and I lumped this in the same category. Anything that's just like tiny little blips on your phone screen, I don't know. Like, what are they going to do next? Make the Gmail app movie? Oh, God. TK, do you have any thoughts on the Emoji Movie? It's Patrick Stewart.
I know, but that was also my most anticipated worst film.
Oh, really?
Well, that's such a stupid premise. Like, okay, what on earth are you going to get out of a series of emojis, regardless of who's voicing them? Like, there's just nothing there. It's just going to be forced and garbage. It's no matter what voice acting you get behind it.
I mean, I can't disagree. It looks terrible. And, but you know, if there is, here, I'm going to play devil's advocate. I don't think that this is going to be a good movie. But if it is, it's going to be for the same reasons that something like the Lego Movie worked. We all thought the Lego Movie was going to be pretty bad because it just seemed like such a blatant cash grab. You know, it's just like Lego, make a movie out of Lego. And that movie turned out great. So who knows? Maybe they'll, no, they're not. Even as I say it, I'm like, this is dumb. What am I talking about? So that was your pick for the worst film of 2017, TK?
That is correct.
All right. Well, I'm going to buck the trend, and I'm going to go with a film that I think is going to be the biggest flop. And that is a movie called Geostorm. Did I mention this on our last episode? I don't think I did.
I don't think so, no.
Have either of you guys heard of Geostorm?
No, I haven't.
TK, have you? Don't look it up.
Not a word.
Okay, guys. I'm going to read you the plot description, and I want you to guess who stars in it. As a man heads into space to prevent climate-controlling satellites from creating a storm of epic proportions, his brother discovers a plot to assassinate the president.
Hang on. His mean tweet is, why does he star in all these terrible movies? Because he has a terrible... It's Gerard Butler!
Gerard Butler stars in Geostorm.
Oh my god.
Written and directed by Dean Devlin.
Oh my god.
The other half of the team behind Independence Day. The guy who isn't Roland Emmerich, who made Independence Day. Also starring Ed Harris, who I'm guessing is playing the villain. Now here's the biggest part of it. Like, not only is that absolutely ludicrous, but apparently this movie has been on the shelf since 2014. Does not bode well. So I'm going to bet that this will be the biggest flop of the year, hands down. But man, that premise, that sounds like a joke. That sounds like a fake movie trailer in front of Tropic Thunder. You know, Scorcher 4, The Meltdown. Like, it sounds like that. And the fact that it even stars Gerard Butler, like, and it's so obviously a Gerard Butler movie, just blows my mind.
From reading your plot summary, it's one sentence, but it sounds like two entirely different movies.
It just sounds like what am... Are they... Maybe they'll try to assassinate the president with the giant storm? They can't trace us if it's a tornado. I just keep laughing at it. All that being said, I think they could have very easily rebranded this movie and people would be more intrigued. And that's by making it the concluding chapter of the Olympus Has Fallen, London Has Fallen trilogy.
Yeah.
And calling it The Sky Has Fallen.
That's awesome, man. Because, like, the whole brother thing, assassinate the president, and you said Gerard Butler, and I'm like, wait a minute, is this related to those other movies? But,
and
I mean,
the answer
it was kind of funny.
No.
Because they move from the White House to all of London, so it's only natural that you go up to outer space and try to turn it into the weather. I mean, it's a natural progression.
Yeah, why not? Maybe if that series really embraced how stupid it was, you know, it could have more longevity. But anyway, and you know who's playing the president? It's not Morgan Freeman. It's Andy Garcia.
Is he going to be on screen for 1 second like he was in Passengers?
My God. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, those are our picks, and I'm just so looking forward to seeing how all this shakes down. Even just like the little questions, like will Trainspotting 2 be good or bad or neither? I'm just so excited, guys, to go on this journey with you again, another year of film for us to discuss.
And what I think is interesting is that we made no mention whatsoever of any of the DC films. They're not on our most anticipated films after last year.
Okay, so I want to, I do have something to say about Wonder Woman, because I feel like this is a significant movie. It is. We're finally getting this big blockbuster superhero movie directed by a woman and starring a female protagonist. And regardless of how the movie is, that is significant. Like, that is a milestone moment in filmmaking. Here's why, and you know, the trailer didn't even look that bad, but here's why I'm skeptical. I kind of feel like DC is hoping that people will, like, I hate to say fall for it, but I feel like they are using those facts and the fact that it is a milestone and the fact that they got there before Marvel, and you know, we have the most famous female superhero of all time, and she's getting her own movie. We're doing a female-led superhero movie before Marvel does. I kind of feel like they're pushing all of that as a marketing move, and I worry that it's not going to be good. It's going to be, you know, Batman versus Superman or Suicide Squad terrible, and we may all feel duped as a result. And I worry about that because I worry that women in blockbuster films, like, that might suffer if Wonder Woman isn't good. So I'm curious, and I really want it to be good, but DC's recent output has been so bad that, I don't know, like, I'm not looking forward to Justice League at all. I don't know about you guys, so... Yeah, I don't know.
It's true. It's like that should be one of the most anticipated films of the year, but it's like they've built it up so badly in Batman versus Superman that there just isn't that buzz that was there for the Avengers.
Yeah, man. DC. It's funny. I was reading an article today where they were talking, DC was talking about doing their Black Adam / Shazam movie series, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He's going to be in the DC cinematic universe. And the top comment on the article was, oh, we're still doing this? Like, DC, you haven't given up yet? Everybody hated all the movies you put out in 2016. We're still going ahead, huh? So, yeah. I wish I could look forward to more. If you want something from DC that's coming out this year that I think will be a lot of fun, the Lego Batman movie. I bet that'll be a good time. All right, fellas. Now, it's time to play The Ticket Price is Right, the box office prediction game, where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released this week, and we also look back on last week's predictions. All the scores are at zero once again as we start our new year of box office predictions that ultimately mean nothing. And last week, we predicted the opening totals for Monster Trucks and The Bye-Bye Man. What a slate to open the year, huh, guys? High hopes for these films, anyone? No?
They were going to be my most anticipated films of the year, but they already came out, so I couldn't.
Yeah, unfortunately, we couldn't talk about them in time. And also, you know what? I'm just going to put it up front. TK, you swept, dude. You won both of these predictions. You said that Monster Trucks would make $10 million. It made $10.9 million. And you said the Bye-Bye Man would make $10 million. It made $13 million. So well done, sir. Well done. I take your silence to be a celebration.
It's sitting back in silent victory.
He's overwhelmed.
This is the only time this will ever happen, because I am very bad at the ticket prices, right?
Well, who knows? Maybe you're just off to a good start. This time, we're predicting two more movies, and again, I wish I could say I was really optimistic about either of these. But first up, Triple X, The Return of Xander Cage. Triple X 3. There's already two threes in the title. It has a budget of $85 million. It is Vin Diesel's return to a franchise that didn't really have a fan base to begin with, I guess. I'm pretty puzzled that this movie is even made. But hey, you know, like last summer they were shooting some scenes down the street from my work. So there's that. So... I get to predict first this week, and I think that Triple X, The Return of Xander Cage, is going to make $25 million. I don't think it's going to do fantastically opening weekend, but Vin Diesel has his fans. TK, how much will Triple X 3 make?
20.
And Robin, what do you think?
I'll go a little higher. I'll go with $28 million, because I think the main reason they resurrected this is because Vin Diesel's Fast and the Furious movies make so much money. And since this is kind of similar, I think there'll be enough of a fan base for it, even though it's been so many years since the original films.
And next up is the new M. Night Shyamalan movie, Split, where James McAvoy has 24 personalities... and he kidnaps Anya Taylor-Joy from The Witch and holds her captive. And the trailer for this one looks really ridiculous, but it is getting shockingly good reviews. It has like almost 80% on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm really surprised. I promised myself I would never be tricked by Shyamalan again, but damn it, I want to see this. And I also heard, without spoiling anything, that this movie implies a Shyamalan cinematic universe. Like, maybe all these movies are connected.
Okay.
Ah, boy. Anyway.
Is he going to, like, bump into Mr. Glass while walking down the street or something like that?
It has a budget of $10 million. I think it will make $20 million. TK, what do you think?
Let's go with 15.
15? And Robin, how about yourself?
I'll go in between. I'll go with 18 million. From what I've read in the reviews so far, they're saying that it's an acting tour de force from James McAvoy, where it's kind of like, no matter how good or bad the film is, that it's worth watching just to see him, how batshit crazy he goes.
So, as an aside, like on a side note related to this, Cate Blanchett is starring in this, I guess it's like an art film that's coming out this year called Manifesto, and she plays something like 14 different characters. And if you watch the trailer, like, you see her, you know, in all these different outfits and all this makeup, playing all these different characters. But the problem is, when you line that many different performances up next to each other, the artifice begins to show. You start to become very aware that it's just this one person putting on funny voices and funny hats and, you know, like showing off their range, but the illusion is shattered because they're not playing just like one or two characters. They're playing so many characters that you can't help but see past all the costume and makeup and see Cate Blanchett underneath it. So I'm kind of wondering about Split with James McAvoy's acting in it, where I'm sure he's good, but if I watch him do 24 different funny voices in a row, like, is it going to just get ridiculous really quickly? I kind of feel like it might. And now, it's time for the dumb joke of the week. Guys, there's a black hole in my living room. It really pulls the room together. No, I'm just kidding. My black hole just takes up space. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
double whammy.
A bad joke piled onto a bad joke.
Once again, TK is completely silent. He's just like, I'm not going to say, is this going to be a trend, TK? Are you just going to ignore the bad jokes from now on?
None of these jokes deserve my reaction. Oh, so far this year.
So far this year, all two of them. I thought last week's was pretty good. Anyway, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at The Back Row. You can contact TK by emailing tk@the-back-row.com. And also, I encourage people to follow TK on Letterboxd so you can see all the movies he's reviewing. So look up Tall Chris, Chris with a K instead of a CH, on letterboxd.com. And you can see what TK is watching. Robin can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com. Be sure to check out The Trail Went Cold at trailwentcold.com, Robin's weekly true crime podcast that he hosts and writes, and I edit and produce it. And of course, is it Suspect Conviction?
Yes, Suspect Conviction. That's the new podcast. It's near the top of the iTunes charts, so you'll be able to find it.
For more true crime goodness, and again, I'll tease that there's going to be a connection to The Trail Went Cold in the future, which we're very excited about. And of course, be sure to check out Robin's writing on the-back-row.com, cracked.com, and listverse.com. He's all over the internet. And I can be found through the-back-row.com. You can email me at gil@the-back-row.com. And of course, you can also find links there to all of my other side projects, rule2productions.com, mcgillfoot.com, if you want to see any of my editing work, my film work, and the various podcasts, including The Trail Went Cold, that I work on. And I'm on Letterboxd as well, if you want to follow me and see all the movies I'm rating. I've just been, like, going through movies, giving ratings, working backwards from the present, and I've been actually having a lot of fun doing it. So MAGILLFOOTE is my handle, McGillfoot on Letterboxd.com. If you want to see all the movies and stuff that I'm watching, you can find out there if I don't mention it here on the podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and here's to another great year of movies. We'll see you next week.
Shouts from the Back Row is part of the Back Row Podcast Network. Visit the-back-row.com for more. The Shouts from the Back Row theme is composed by Vince Nitro.